It's called presidential harassment.
I want nothing.
And it's unfortunate.
I want no quid pro quo.
This should never, ever happen to another president, ever.
I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly. He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney. Yeah, sure.
Shut up,
Rudy.
Shut up.
Okay, hold on.
Shut up.
Hold on.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What they've done to General Flynn.
Russia, Russia, Russia.
What they've done to others.
It was all bull.
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about all of President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me. Ken is my co-host, a criminal defense attorney, and former federal prosecutor. Ken blogs at popehat.com. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So the Senate Intelligence Committee has released its final report on Russian interference in the 2016 election. The president says the report is a hoax, though his aides say it confirms what they've said all along, that there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government to influence the election outcome. Of course, collusion has no particular legal meaning, and whether you think there was collusion with the Russian government depends in part on what people and entities you consider to be acting as agents of the Russian government. So I guess let's talk about one particular episode that is key to this collusion question the report. The report finds this allegation to be substantiated that shortly before the release of the Access Hollywood tape, near the end of the 2016 campaign, that's the tape where the president said it was possible for him to, quote, grab women by the pussy. When people around Trump got word that the tape would be coming, Trump associate Roger Stone directed his other associate, Jerome Corsi, to instruct Julian Assange of WikiLeaks to have emails that had been hacked from John Podesta, the Clinton campaign chairman, to have those emails released. Of course, those emails had been hacked by the Russians. So I guess, is that collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government, Ken?
That highlights what you said earlier, Josh, that collusion isn't really a word that has a specific legal meaning. It's colloquially collusion. They're you know, working together, but it's not necessarily illegal collusion because, as we've discussed before, it's not against the law to disseminate something that was illegally obtained. So it's not a crime necessarily if WikiLeaks or the Russian government hacked into the Democrats' servers to participate in later distributing that. This starts to feel like a greatest hits episode or a eclipse episode where we're going through some of the same things we've gone through for the last 2 years. But these themes keep recurring. So definitely this report, and it's surprising that both Democrats and Republicans were so unified on the facts here, definitely seems to suggest that Trump participated, that Stone participated in this effort to direct when WikiLeaks would release these emails. That's established. But that's not necessarily a crime because they do not have evidence that they participated in the initial decision to hack or in directing that hack.
So one of the key questions here has been what President Trump or then candidate Trump knew about what Roger Stone and various other people around him were up to. The president provided written answers at one point during the Mueller investigation, saying that he didn't recall discussing WikiLeaks with Roger Stone. Now, this report, and as you note, this is a bipartisan report approved by Republicans and Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has worked together much more productively than the House Intelligence Committee has over the last few years. This report calls the president's claims into question there and strongly suggests that the president was involved in this decision and was discussing with Roger Stone the WikiLeaks releases. So, I mean, did the president make false statements there? Could you bring a 1001 prosecution against the president for making false statements during this investigation?
You could, although with Trump and the way Trump acts, it's always a little difficult to prove intent.
Even when he's answering questions in writing?
Even when he's answering questions in writing. I mean, in an era where we can't agree on the same facts, it is somewhat remarkable that Democrats and Republicans agreed on some pretty startling facts in this report. Of course, they completely disagree on the meaning of those facts and whether it means there was never any basis for the investigation and whether there was collusion and so on. But they do strongly imply that the president lied to Mueller about this chain of events, this human centipede of idiocy that goes from Trump to Stone to Corsi to Julian Assange about releasing these emails. In a federal prosecution, the trick would be to prove that Trump knew at the time he was lying, that he remembered it correctly, that he wasn't just addled or confused or arguing or whatever it is. For most normal humans, I think a prosecutor would feel fairly comfortable in that case. With someone as prone to talking the way Trump talks, I think it's a little bit more of a stretch.
So in terms of, did people know that they were making false statements when they made them? The Senate committee made criminal referrals of a number of associates of the president back in 2019. Sam Clovis, Steve Bannon, and Eric Prince. They accused each of them of having made false statements during the course of this investigation. They also sent a letter that called into question testimony from Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner that was contradicted by former Manafort aide Rick Gates in his own testimony, although the committee didn't specifically accuse Donald Trump Jr. or Jared Kushner of having committed a crime when providing that testimony that whose veracity they call into question. We don't have any indication that the Justice Department ever did anything with that criminal referral, right? I mean, I know that ordinarily, criminal referrals from Congress can be a little bit performative. They can be a way of trying to throw political mud on your opponents. But this would be a little bit different, again, in that this committee acted in a pretty bipartisan manner. So if there was a criminal referral here, it was issued with the agreement of Republicans and Democrats.
Sure. It's a little more credible in that it's bipartisan. But I think it's still going to be seen as you suggested, somewhat performative, somewhat political. I mean, right now, the way Attorney General Barr appears to be running the Justice Department, there seems to be not a lot of chance that it'll actually ever go anywhere. Now, that may be completely different if Joe Biden wins the presidency and we have a different Justice Department. But for now, these are the types of prosecutions that certainly would have the involvement of higher up people in the Justice Department and are the sort of things that would be quashed by Barr.
Is this the sort of thing that could be taken up in a Joe Biden Justice Department if he were to win this election? Would we still be within the statute of limitations for a prosecution to be brought if that was appropriate?
Sure. It's a 5-year statute of limitations for this sort of thing from the time of the alleged lie. It would be well within the statute. I think it would be probably a stronger case against some of these people who are not so much known for being rhetorically incontinent. I think it's a strong possibility. A lot of these things, I think, are going to come down to whether or not a hypothetical Biden administration is going to have sort of a Gerald Ford type approach to things, that, you know, we need to put this long national nightmare behind us and move on to focusing on other things, or whether they have more of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission approach where wrongdoing was done and we've got to right it. So that's a lot about how much political capital a hypothetical Biden presidency wants to spend on relitigating Trump issues.
What else is significant in this report? I mean, one thing is that this report is more clear than the Mueller report was about this associate of Paul Manafort, Konstantin Kalimnik, being a Russian intelligence agent. Mueller was a little more circumspect about exactly what his link to the Russians was. Now, obviously, that Paul Manafort had this associate with whom he was sharing polling and other internal information in the Trump campaign and discussing strategy is a counterintelligence concern. Are there criminal or prosecutorial upshots of that finding, or is that just an interesting counterintelligence finding?
I think it's a counterintelligence finding primarily, and it certainly justifies the interest of the FBI in this whole series of events. It does absolutely lay out Kalimnik as an actual operative as opposed to merely being connected to Russian intelligence. And it paints a picture of Manafort advancing his own interests through this connection and very much exchanging information, not just passively receiving it, but providing information to Kalimnik about Trump's strategy that then guides and shapes what the Russians offer back. So I think it really establishes beyond a shadow of a doubt that the FBI was correct to be concerned about Russian interference in the process. And I think that is somewhat bipartisan, even if the Republicans argue that this is something that shows no collusion. I think that's difficult to argue with respect to Manafort. The question is whether or not Manafort was really acting on behalf of the Trump campaign or really out for his own ends and his own clients.
Yeah, because I think one of the key questions here is the extent to which the FBI had a good reason to be pursuing this investigation and then to be pursuing it in the specific manner in which it did. And one of the implicit arguments we've been hearing for years is that if certain things we're talking about, if they are not criminal acts, in some cases, if they are just policy disagreements about how friendly the U.S. posture ought to be toward Russia, that's not really a proper matter for a criminal investigation. But in addition to some genuinely criminal matters here, we have all of these counterintelligence aspects, and that's one that points toward the FBI having been on good grounds to open and pursue this investigation. But the report is still critical of the FBI's handling of certain aspects of the investigation and certain things that it pursued, right? And I mean, do you how broadly do you buy into the Republican argument here that there was really significant FBI overreach, that they were pursuing things that were not really any of their business because of a broad sense that Donald Trump was sleazy or bad?
I don't think that the report supports that broad of a criticism about the FBI. The report does support some fairly standard criticisms of the FBI, that they can be far too gullible in accepting information from favored sources. Here, that favored source being Christopher Steele and the infamous dossier. The report suggests that they were really too gullible in moving forward with that and not critical enough of the information in the source. And any defense attorney will tell you that the FBI is traditionally puts too much trust in some of its sources of information and relies and moves forward based on that information without verifying it. But no, the upshot of the report is very strongly that there was, at the very least, lots and lots of smoke justifying the FBI looking for a fire.
Isn't some of the question here not about whether the FBI should have started looking at these things, but if and when it should have stopped looking at certain things? I mean, in particular, you had Carter Page, there was a FISA warrant to surveil his communications, which was repeatedly renewed. And my broad sense has been that the initial warrant application was on solid ground, but some of the renewals were not on very solid ground, and that the FBI sort of should have realized that it no longer had good reason to pursue that surveillance when it continued to do so.
I think you can say that in a sort of Monday morning quarterbacking sort of way, but in the moment, there is a lot of information here that would have made the FBI justifiably suspicious and concerned about intelligence operatives from the Russians trying to interfere with the election and getting involved with the Trump campaign. And interestingly, with respect to Carter Page, the report does portray him as someone who was investigated for things that didn't ultimately pan out. But it also portrays him as I think we've argued in the past, as his own worst enemy, as someone who is extremely evasive, can't give a straight answer, and really prolonged the process by the way he acted. One of the reasons that you shut up and don't talk to the FBI, don't go on TV and talk about your case, don't go and blab to Congress, is not just that you don't want to incriminate yourself, but that if you're the sort of person who's incapable of giving a credible answer to a simple question, you just make them more suspicious of you. And this report sort of portrays Carter Page in that way, as someone who was his own worst enemy in the sense of making himself seem like someone who did something wrong.
I mean, certainly that was how I perceived Carter Page, watching him on television through this period. I guess the question is whether the FBI has a greater responsibility to be circumspect about that sort of thing than I do as a news viewer and commentator watching someone behave very strangely on television. I mean, we do have this FBI lawyer, Kevin Kleinsmith, who's pleaded guilty to one count of making false statements because he falsified an email during one of these FISA warrant processes, basically downplaying the existing relationship that Carter Page had to the CIA. And Page would have looked at least at the margin less suspicious perhaps in the eyes of the FISA FISA court, if they had known that he had some ongoing relationship with the CIA. And so I guess, you know, this is the first indictment in the John Durham investigation, the investigation where the Trump Justice Department is investigating the investigators. What do you make of the fact that there is now a guilty plea? Someone has pleaded guilty to a crime related essentially to this idea that the FBI was overzealous and failed to respect the rights of Carter Page.
Well, it's a fairly remarkable plea on a number of levels. First of all, it's incredibly unusual for someone who's an investigator or prosecutor to suffer criminal consequences for making a false statement in any sort of warrant application. It happens all the time, and the vast majority of the time, there are no consequences whatsoever. Also, the particular nature of the false statement here is one that kind of revives all our discussions in the past that came up in the Flynn case about what type of misstatement is material, makes a difference, and what doesn't. Here, the misstatement was suggesting that the CIA had said that Page was not an official source, which in fact he was not, but it was misleading in the sense that it attributed to the CIA an affirmative statement about that and had the effect of downplaying his past connections to the CIA. I mean, that's a bit of a stretch under normal circumstances, although if you were a mere mortal and not a government agent, you could very well get charged with it. But it kind of it illustrates the way that we see this materiality issue very differently and argumentatively, how when it's Flynn lying to the guys coming to interview him in the White House, we have this one view of materiality about whether or not his statements make a difference, and very much another when you have someone lying in a way that's going to get to a court. But the main thing is, this almost never happens. A government agent who lies in the process of getting a warrant facing any sort of real consequence for that.
Shouldn't a government agent be held to a higher standard on false statements charges than a member of the public who's being investigated would be? I mean, doesn't an FBI lawyer have both a greater duty to deal honestly with investigative agents of the federal government, and then also obviously, you know, he obviously knows what his obligations are to make true statements. So, I mean, shouldn't it be easier to bring this sort of prosecution rather than harder?
That's a beautiful world you're describing, Josh, but it's not the world we live in. Agents and prosecutors generally get away with much more than we mere mortals and are all the time held to more lax standards than the rest of us.
I saw Susan Hennessy from Brookings, one of the Lawfare blog writers over there, saying that, you know, she thought that Kleinsmith's behavior was the sort of thing that he should obviously be terminated for. She thought that the charges here were a stretch, but that it's his call whether to plead to them. What do you make of his choice as a defendant to plead guilty to this? Is this the sort of thing that he could have reasonably fought if the government was going to charge him if he didn't agree to plead guilty here?
Probably not. The trick is that people don't get charged in his position. It's not that it's unusually difficult to convict him once he is charged. So the standard for what is or isn't a material statement is so flexible and broad that it would have been a very tough defense for him, and one where going to trial would have been hugely expensive, likely to raise the resulting sentence substantially, and unlikely to succeed. So no, it's not a particularly surprising decision to make to plead guilty and hope for a more lenient outcome, which probably includes straight probation rather than custodial time.
Except that because this case is so political, isn't that an advantage in certain ways to defendants on either side here, that you have the opportunity to lean into the idea that you are being pursued for political reasons, making it more difficult to get a conviction or maybe even more difficult to get an indictment, as we saw with the apparent failure to indict Andrew McCabe by the D.C. U.S. attorney. And then you'd also have the possibility that President Trump will lose this election in a few months. Who knows what the appetite of a Biden Justice Department would be to pursue a false statements prosecution that had been essentially part of a pet project of the Trump DOJ trying to discredit the investigation into Trump's own campaign.
Well, I think that if he's pleading guilty now, they were ready to indict him. And it's quite a different thing to decide not to indict and to dismiss an existing indictment. I think it would have been very politically risky for a hypothetical Biden administration to dismiss an indictment against him after he'd been indicted. I mean, we saw what controversy arose out of the Flynn situation with that. As to arguments at trial, we've seen that that type of approach has had extremely mixed success. You know, it didn't work for Roger Stone. It didn't work for Michael Avenatti. It didn't work for a number of these people who tried to suggest that they were being singled out for political reasons. And a lot of the time, juries just cut through that stuff. Also, you have to understand the incredible expense and stress and trauma of going through the entire process and a trial, and the harm it does to yourself and to your family. And it might just be that a plea, which has the very high likelihood of getting you straight probation, is the rational way out of it.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about Roger Stone. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with Attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. Roger Stone, who was convicted for lying to Congress during the Russia investigation, among other matters, has dropped the appeal of his conviction. Of course, the president had already fully commuted his sentence. So I guess, Ken, the thinking here would be he's probably not going to win the appeal, and there's not a lot of point in pursuing the appeal when there's no punishment for him to get out of?
Well, he issued a statement saying basically that because of the taint of politics, he would never be able to get a fair trial, and that this was ending the fight was best for him and his family, and so forth. Realistically, I think that it's after he's been relieved of most of the consequences, it's not worth the money. There's also a fascinating issue of what would happen if he won on appeal and was given a new trial. Then he comes back and he's convicted again. Well, the commutation applied to his old sentence. Would it apply to a new sentence on the same charges? That's not clear. So really, it might be a matter of the bird in the hand being better than the two in the bush and getting out with the no-consequence felony or few-consequences felony when you have it.
Let's talk about emoluments. There are three lawsuits alleging that the president has accepted unlawful foreign emoluments in the form of payments to his hotels. One is brought by the attorneys general of the District of Columbia and Maryland. One is brought by congressional Democrats. And one was brought by the liberal pressure group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington on behalf of business owners who compete with Trump's hotels. So different courts have gone different ways on these lawsuits and on one of the key questions in all of them, which is who, if anyone, has standing to bring this lawsuit and say, I am harmed by the president's unlawful acceptance of emoluments. So in the case brought by Crew, this pressure group, on behalf of the private businesses, a three-judge panel of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals had said they did have standing, and the whole court just declined to reconsider en banc with all the Second Circuit judges that question of whether there is standing here. So I guess now, is the next likely step the Supreme Court? Would the Supreme Court take up all three of these cases at once? What would, you know, what is the process there for figuring out, can anyone actually sue the president over this?
Well, right now, you have the petition that was from the D.C. Circuit, which was the case by Democratic lawmakers. The D.C. Circuit found that the lawmakers didn't have standing, and a petition to the Supreme Court to review that is currently pending. The court hasn't decided whether to take it up yet. The Fourth Circuit, in an en banc ruling, said that Maryland and D.C.'s case could move forward. And I don't believe there's a petition to the Supreme Court on that yet. And now you have this Second Circuit one. I think the most likely scenario is that there winds up being three petitions and that the Supreme Court accepts them all or rejects them all. There is now a split of circuit authority, which is the sort of thing that the Supreme Court normally takes up. But again, it may turn, the saying is that the Supreme Court watches election results. The Supreme Court may decide that whether or not to take up these cases based on what happens in November. They may decide that it's not something that's necessary if Trump loses.
Well, but so if they didn't take any of the cases up, then some of them would proceed, right? I mean, the Second Circuit case, the plaintiffs have won at this stage. So if the Supreme Court declined to review any of it, then would we still see this litigation proceeding even in the theoretical case where Trump is no longer in office?
Yes, assuming the plaintiffs wanted to continue to move it forward, even if Trump was not in office, then that case and the Fourth Circuit case would be moving forward. But that would just mean that they might eventually reach a higher court with a more developed record, factually and legally, and that might be something that's more appealing for the Supreme Court, rather than just on the earliest stages, which are less appealing.
Supposing that eventually this did work its way through litigation and you had some sort of trial about whether the president had been receiving these emoluments, what would the remedy be, assuming that it's a former President Trump that we're talking about at that point, so there could be no ongoing emoluments that he was receiving? Would he have to disgorge the payments that he had received from those foreign governments? What would the courts actually be doing if they made a ruling?
We don't know. I mean, this is not something that has been litigated this way before. I think you can expect that if Trump loses, that the argument will be that the lawsuits are moot, that the only type of relief that might be available is declaratory or injunctive, and that that is now moot with Trump being out of office. I don't think it's settled what type, if any, of monetary relief is available, whether it's some sort of damages or merely disgorgement. I mean, theoretically, I guess you could still have disgorgement even after Trump's out of office. But this is just purely, this is new law being made, and we don't know how it'll play out.
There are also these book lawsuits. The president's brother, Robert Trump, had been the plaintiff in the lawsuit against Mary Trump, alleging that she had violated a non-disclosure agreement by writing a tell-all book about the president and their family. Robert Trump recently passed away just a few days ago. So what does that mean for that lawsuit? Can his estate continue to sue Mary Trump over that NDA? And what kind of damages could a dead person have from the violation of an agreement not to disclose information about that dead person?
So in general, a dead person's estate can substitute into a lawsuit on their behalf. It's procedurally possible. But every case is different, and sometimes the death of a person can really prevent a case from going forward, particularly if they're an essential witness and there's no deposition or other recording of their testimony of the sort that could be used, or if the damages are of a nature that they can't recover. I think it's too early to say here whether or not the Robert Trump estate can come up with a theory by which it is harmed. I think they may try to, or they may use this as an opportunity to sort of quietly walk away now that the main thrust of the suit has failed.
Which is to say they hope to block the publication of the book, which they did not do.
They hope to block the publication of the book, possibly, or they hope to use the process for political gain. In other words, they hope to whip up this narrative of the evil mainstream media manipulating members of the Trump family to tell lies about him. That part, I mean, to Trump's base, maybe succeeded. Overall, given that it drove huge sales of the book and was not successful in stopping the book's publication, I think it failed.
What about Michael Cohen's book? This book is now, it's called Disloyal. It's available for pre-order. It's going to be released on September 8th. The introduction is available. It talks about Donald Trump being involved in some sort of golden showers. Where's the lawsuit over this book? Michael Cohen, the president's former attorney, seems like he had a legal responsibility not to write a tell-all about the president. Where's that lawsuit?
Well, I don't think we can assume there won't be one. Trump has so far often come roaring in at the last minute in a way to maximize disruption of the publication process with his demands. It's entirely plausible he'll come in with something between now and September 8th. Or it's possible, I guess, that his team has learned a lesson, that this doesn't work out well and it merely drives higher sales of the books and more attention to the books. So it could be a strategic, sensible decision not to do it.
Finally, let's talk about a lawsuit where the president is on the receiving end. Neil Young is suing to stop the Trump campaign from playing his music. We see a lot of these news stories where politicians, especially Republican politicians, are playing some sort of music and the band says, you know, you can't play our music. You have no right to do that. They send a cease and desist letter. My usual understanding had been that the musicians were not on good legal footing here, that you get these sort of blanket licenses for all kinds of music to use at your political rallies and that that in general, the campaigns have a right to do this, even if it annoys the musicians. But Neil Young says that the Trump campaign is in fact infringing his copyright on certain songs. Does he have a good argument? Could he prevail in a lawsuit against the Trump campaign over them using his music against his specific instruction?
Well, it depends on the specific facts. Usually, these controversies are mostly performative. The musician makes a stink about it so that they can express their disdain for the particular musician. The politician uses that or doesn't to gesture towards their own base, and nothing legal ever happens. The right to use the music is usually bundled with a lot of other music and given licenses by a couple of big organizations that license to entertainment and organizations and venues and things like that. There is a way for musicians to keep their music out of political use through these license bundling organizations. And the question is going to be, did Neil Young do that, at least as to this music that was used? Was it excluded from bundled licenses that the Trump campaign purchased access to? If so, then there is a colorable case that Neil Young might be able to move forward with, although there are always defenses as well to this sort of thing. And the question will be, again, is this an old-fashioned lawsuit where you're trying to get a result, or is it a modern lawsuit where you're doing it for the media attention and for the posturing?
If Neil Young is right that his copyright here is being infringed, what would his damages be? I mean, is a reason that you don't see more lawsuits brought over this, obviously litigation is expensive, and then what do you get if you win the litigation at the end?
Well, there are statutory damages that can be as much as $150,000 per incident, but probably for Neil Young, this is not meant as a money-making approach. It's more of a matter of pride and a matter of performance. So he could certainly get a good chunk of change if it's being used a lot by the Trump campaign, but it's not something that someone with his assets is really going to get super richer over.
There's much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it this week. Ken White, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail at 424-538-8888. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.